Okay, we're doing the second of our series of five on the 13 principles of faith. So today, I want to wrap up a few questions from last time and then do principle number five, which is prayer. So I want to look at an overview with you. First, let me tell you that there's an additional handout that Rabbi Levy brought because he thought he might be teaching today. So if you want it, you can take that additional handout. It's a packet. And so the handout that I gave you includes the 13 principles and then the source in the Torah. And the handout that he prepared, so I have some extra handouts that I made. The handout that he prepared is the principle as we see it in the Siddur, and then the long version in the Rambam. That's that packet right there. So that's an optional packet. Not everybody has to take that one. Are you coming for another packet?
Yes. Do you have another extra?
Do I have another extra?
Do you have more of yours or not?
I brought five of mine today.
I haven't from last week, but I just don't have it.
Okay, so let me just tell you that it's available on my website, abiteoftorah.com.
B-I-T-E,
like a cookie. abiteoftorah.com, go to audio, go down the audio, there's a whole long list. Go to philosophy, and it'll pop out 13 principles. Go on 13 principles, it'll be last week's class, plus the handout from last week and this week is on the website.
Is it okay?
For sure. Please. I'm supposed to do this in 5 weeks, which is ridiculously too little for 13 major principles. However, that's what we're going to do. We're just going to do an overview of the 13 principles, okay? So last week what we looked at was the first four, which all have to do with the existence of God. This week we're just going to look at number five, just so you know what the math is going to be. Next week, we're going to look at 6, 7, 8, and 9, and then 10 and 11, and then 12 and 13. That's how I group them. I might be skipping a week, or I believe you might take one of those weeks, because November 4th, I won't be here. So hopefully he'll just do something else, because I want to do all five. That's the truth. Of the two ways that there are to express why we have 13 principles. The way that I've commonly heard is that if you don't believe in these 13, you don't believe in Judaism. You might believe Jewish things, but Judaism includes these 13. So anyone who rejects one of these isn't actually believing in the package of Judaism. That's the way it's commonly expressed, and I have a hard time with that, you know, just because I don't like to say somebody doesn't accept the whole thing, especially today, when we're so unraveled in terms of our ability to hold on to the whole package. So the way that I heard Rabbi Becher express it, I liked very much. He said, these are the 13 core things that you need to know to be able to have a relationship with God. So I like that much better, because it really helps just to have some basic parameters to understand how, from where do you cultivate this relationship. So just for instance, if you go on a blind date with somebody, right, so you would have to know that person is human, not an alien dressed up in human skin. It makes a difference, right? Because if you expect them to peel off a mask and look like a lizard at any moment, then you can't really, like, what do you trust and where do you proceed from? So proceeding from that they're a human being, that they're hopefully, because your friend set you up, a generally respectful person, hopefully if they say they went to college, you could trust that. Like those things, you start from there and can build on that. So that's what this is. Where do we start from in trying to cultivate a relationship with God? So these are the basic principles and premises. So last week we looked at God, God's existence, and we for sure didn't get to finish the whole thing, but the basic concepts, we'll just review them quickly. That God alone made, does make, and makes all things. So God is the cause of everything. Greater than the concept of first cause, but God is the cause of everything. That God is one, that there is no divisibility in God at all. You can't separate God into different things. We talk about different names of God, different aspects of God, but that's just from our perspective. That's not from God's perspective. From God's perspective, he's solid state, no moving parts at all. You can't take anything, you can't tease anything out. It's only what we perceive and how we relate to God that we say different things. So it just has to do with where we're standing around God, so to speak, or what our perspective is. But God is indivisible. That there's no anthropomorphic property at all. He has no body, any physicality implies limit. So there, if there's an edge of something, then that's where they end and something else begins. So there isn't that with God. We said, that being said, it's quite confusing to think about God. The reason why I'm bringing this up is that we're going to go into it today. What about God's, the Kabbalistic concept of tzimtzum, of God's contracting God's self to create a space for the world to exist inside of. So how is that, and does that bring an edge to God or not? It's very confusing. So we still know that there is no physicality at all. There can't be an edge beyond which God doesn't exist. That also being said, I'll just, for whoever knows this word, a chilul Hashem, has anybody ever heard of a chilul Hashem? A desecration of God's name. Chilul Hashem, chilul with a chet, not Hillel with a hey, like Hillel Academy, Hillel, two lamets. It means, halal means empty space or a vacuum. So in modern Hebrew, the word halal is used for space. A halalit is a spaceship. A Hillel Hashem is a space in which God doesn't exist. Right? That's what a desecration of God's name is, where a human being would do something so egregious that it causes, in a sense, God's presence to scatter, to leave that place, to leave that domain. So it's possible for a human to create a space where God can't exist. That's what a chilul Hashem is. So does that imply physicality? It does not. It's just that we can't wrap our minds around how that could, how a non-physical could move out of a space. So it's more metaphoric. But that is what a desecration of God's name means, is that you've created a place where God's presence isn't welcome, or it's such an abominable thing that you did that God doesn't want to be there. So either you've unwelcomed, or you've created a space in which he says, not me, I'm not going there, and whatever that is. Okay, we'll get back to that. And then finally, that God is the first and the last, meaning before, the totally and completely above time. With that, let's move into this week's Parsha for just a second.
Does that mean that there's no beginning, no end?
No beginning and no end at all. At all. So there never was a time before God. You can't even say time, but there never was anything before God. There can't possibly be anything after, because God is before and after everything. There is nothing that exists except God. And we are just a puff of whatever we are in the midst of eternity. But there is a beginning to us and an end to us, unlike for God. With that being said, here's a philosophic concept to wrap your mind around a little bit. Okay, so we know, I'm sure you're all aware, Abraham had 10 tests, right? Have you heard of Abraham's 10 tests? Yeah? So I can't list them all for you, but I can tell you the first and the last. And the first test is this week's parsha, Lech Lecha. Go from your land, right? The last test is the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, sacrifice your son. What are these two tests? Right? So one way to understand these two tests. Lech Lecha, it's interesting, the whole language of Lech Lecha is go to yourself. My children, when they learned how to translate, they went to an Ivris school, not Ivrit Bivrit. It wasn't Hebrew taught in Hebrew, it was Hebrew taught in Hebrew with a Ashkenazic accent. So it was Ivris B'Ivris, a very right-wing religious but taught in Hebrew school. So, but they learned how to translate into modern-day Hebrew. So they took the biblical Hebrew, translated it into modern Hebrew, and then translated it into English. So when they would do a verse, they had a song that they would sing of the three ways for each phrase. So that verse is Lech Lecha, Lech Me'artzecha, Lech lecha me'artzecha me'moladecha, whatever the whole thing is. You have to translate each one. So lech lecha, I'll just give you an example. So they would sing the song. Lech lecha, lech la'atzmecha, go to yourself. Right, so it was the Hebrew, the biblical Hebrew, the modern Hebrew, the English. Now this particular translation stuck in my mind because it's a very unusual translation, and translation according to the commentaries. Often people translate lech lecha as a strong imperative, go from your land, right? But it's not really, it's go to somewhere. Before you go from your land, from your birthplace, from your father's home, it's go to somewhere where? Lecha, go to yourself, right? So it's a very interesting thing to think about. How do you go to yourself? How do you move into yourself? You have to leave behind your past. Leave behind where you were born, leave behind your parentage, leave behind your social milieu, all that stuff. You have to separate yourself out from that which you were raised inside and then go into yourself. So that's Avraham's first test, is cut yourself off from your past and go to yourself. I'll show you where to go, but that's the first test, is release your past. Then he's got all the middle tests and developing who he is. But the final test is sacrifice your son, right? What is that? Right? So here Avraham's working his whole life to teach against human sacrifice and towards the connection to God. But not just that, he's been promised by God that this is going to create a whole sea change in the philosophy of mankind, and that he's going to be a father of a nation. And at first he thinks, well, how am I possibly going to be a father of a great nation because my wife is barren? He takes another wife and he has another kid, and he's told, no, it's not going to be that kid, it's going to be a different kid. And he finally has that other kid, and now he's told to kill that kid. Right? So what's going on? God is saying, release your future.
Trust.
Right? Totally trick. Don't be your past and don't be your future. Because if you think about it, right? So we talk about yesterday is history, tomorrow is a mystery, today is a gift. That's why we call it the present. Right? But what is the present? The present is only where past and future meet, that split second. And we can't ever actually live in it. Because the second that we've lived it, it's past. And when we're first thinking about it, it's future. So the present doesn't really exist. Right? We're always in that space right in between past and future. Where is the present? The present is Hashem. Hashem is above time. There is no past, present, or future of Hashem. There's only present. He exists with no timeline. Time is only a construct for us to understand in a linear fashion how things work, but Hashem is totally transcendent from time. So in order to totally exist, if we don't want to exist just in the past and just in the future, but if we actually want to exist in the present, then we can't live linearly. We have to live vertically in total connection to Hashem, because that's the only thing that actually exists. Whereas our past and our future don't really. Right? Right? That's what I said, if you could wrap your mind around this. Okay, so this is a big philosophical concept, something to take home and chew on, but something to think about. Okay, so when you say there is no, Hashem is the first and Hashem is the last, Hashem is all. That's all there is. And then he made us. And we're not actually anything. So it's interesting to think about when we talk about creation ex nihilo, Hashem made something out of nothing. But Rav Dessler really says it's the opposite. Hashem made nothing out of something. Because if Hashem is all there is, if Hashem is everything and he's eternal, so what did he do? Out of himself, eternity, out of the actual something, he took a piece and made nothing. Something that has a beginning and an end that will cease and make no difference.
So when you say we're not anything, you mean physically? Like we have a beginning and an end physically, but
in the cosmic reality of everything, what difference do we make? You know, that's the whole Horton Hears a Who, Dr. Seuss genius. I don't know if you're familiar with that story, right? A person is a person no matter how small, right? So Horton, the elephant, hears the who's a being on a dust speck on a clover, right? So the dust speck is a whole world. And Horton, the elephant, realizes that there's this tiny little being, and it doesn't matter how small you are, but that's really for a metaphor for ourselves. How small are we in comparison to the entire universe? Where we live on a dust speck, we think of this whole world as so big, but really we're just a tiny little thing on a dust speck floating through the universe. Like, what are we?
There's something eternal about us, our soul, our body has beginning and end. But
right. Right. So what's eternal is our soul has the potential to be eternal. It is blown into us by God. And if you think about breath, breath is something that comes from inside of us. So it's connected to us, but not us. So that's why the expression of blown into us is used, that God breathed the soul into Adam. So there is something of God in us.
That's the eternal.
Yeah, that's the eternal peace, to the extent that we choose to make it eternal. Because that eternal potential peace is wrapped up inside this physical going to turn into dust piece. So it's up to us to figure out how to use this physical thing to impact on that eternal potential thing to actually make it eternal. So that's how we use the physical to attach the spiritual to the eternal is how eternal we become. Right, does that make sense so far? Okay.
But isn't that also the concept that we're nothing but we're everything? I mean, isn't that also kind of a piece of
it? It's not that we're nothing but we're everything. It's that we're nothing, but the whole world was created for us. So we're the center of everything, and we're nothing. We're supposed to hold both of those on. Not that we are everything, because we're not, but that the whole world was created for me, which is a little less than I'm everything. Right, but we are supposed to be that egotistical to say the entire world was created for me. So I should feel that every single one of you and your entire lives and extended lives are all created for as an arena for me to exercise myself in. And each one of you thinks that also about each one of us, that we populate your theater of operation so that you can learn how to operate in that and create eternity through your interaction with all those that you come into contact with. So each one of us has to hold that, to know that we are, in a sense, it's empowering and also daunting to know that it all depends on me, all of it, because it all does, but not the whole sweep of the world, because on the other hand, I'm nothing. You know, without me, would your lives be that different? It wouldn't. There'd be somebody else sitting here teaching you stuff, okay, maybe slightly differently, but really, like, it wouldn't make that big a difference to the entire world if I didn't exist. But it would and it wouldn't, right? So you got to hold both of those, right? I make all the difference, I make zero difference. Both at the same time. And you have to hold on to both of those at the same time to have the right amount of ego to get you going and the right amount of humility to keep you grounded. So, so there's both, right, that you have to deal with at all times. So that brings us to prayer. But I'll stop for any questions if there's more questions. Yeah. Yes.
If everything that was created was us, and there's the beginning and the end, aren't we just as important to God as God is important to us? Maybe even more so, because without us, what does...
We're very important to God, so that's a great question.
The only thing that there is to God
is what he created.
Because that beginning and the end, if you look at it collectively, and we all have our individual collective beginning and end, but let's look broadly from the very, very beginning
of human
very,
existence.
Very end, whenever the end is.
Of human existence.
Of human existence. Uh-huh. Without human existence, there's really no God.
Well.
Because God is just a void that was always there and always.
No, not a void that was always there, a presence
void,
that was always
an
there.
Existence that was
an existence there. That's always there. So God exists independent of us and does not need us to exist. That being said, it's very difficult to use this language, but we use it anyway because it's the only language we have, but it can't mean what I'm saying. God desired to share himself with others. How do you say desire by God? You can't, because it implies a lack. Desiring implies that you're lacking something, so that's where I'm saying it's difficult to use that language, but it's the only language that we have, so we have to use it. So God did desire to share God's self with others, and so created others in God's image to create relationships with, so that God could share God's self. The only way God could share God's self fully and deeply is with someone who's created themselves from the starting point of God's image into a being that can be in relationship with God. So if you just think about a child, are you a parent? Do you have a child? So if you think about a child when they're first born, so they're in relationship but only in receiver mode of the relationship. They can only receive. That first smile at 6 weeks, 8 weeks is so precious because they're first giving back, right? They're first showing that they appreciate the relationship, right? And then the first times they say, I love you, I need you, I want you. It's so meaningful. As a child, it's great. When they're 22, it's even better.
I mean, they actually say that.
They do. It was so great. A few years ago on Pesach, I think my son is 19 at the time, he had his 4 cups of wine. He was quite inebriated. Right, so we're in the kitchen. Maybe it's just 2 cups, but he probably had 4 by then. So we're in the kitchen trying to serve. He's like, Imam, I don't tell you this very often, but I love you so much. You're the best mother. You've raised us so well. I just appreciate everything you do and how you take care of us. I'm like, I'm getting you drunk every night for your life. This is fabulous. Right? But it means so much more when they don't need you. Right? When they choose to be, now 19 still needs you, but when they choose to be in a relationship with you, after you've gotten them to the point of independence, where they can now take flight completely and fly away if they choose to, but they choose to be part of you, that's huge, right? That's huge. And it's a very different relationship than you have with a 3-year-old or even a 10-year-old who needs you so much that hopefully they don't have much of an option but to love you and depend on you.
I think that's exactly what I was... that touches exactly to what I was thinking, that what you're talking about is parenting. And I'm a parent and I have 2 children, so what made me a parent is having those children. Children...
You wouldn't be a parent, but you would still exist.
I'm just but I'm just me.
Right.
My point was about God and us from the beginning and the end. Without us, it's almost like God is not a parent, he's just a being.
Correct. So, but he's still a being, he still exists. So without us, he's not a parent, he's not a king, he doesn't have a relationship with others, he can't be a giver without something to give to.
But that interdependent relationship of me and my children, I need them as much as they need me, and I think that was my...
Right, that's the initial thing, is that we do need each other. So we have to use a mashal, a parable, only goes to a certain extent, and then you have to take it further, right? So when we talk about God as a parent or God as a king, it's only a parable. It's only to help us understand from what we do understand of parenting relationships, something that has to be taken much further than that. So there is that interdependent relationship and that God needs us in order to be king, but God can't need anything. We need. God doesn't need. Our children need us. We need God. So that works. But God's need for us doesn't work. But the fact that God can't be a parent or can't be a king without something to parent or be a king over, that is true. What does that mean exactly? Right. So, but the parent. So, what I'm talking about here is that in thinking about the parenting and why I used that example is because the interdependence that exists now, the parent-child relationship that we use to describe us and God, is actually an inferior relationship to the lover relationship that we can use to describe our relationship with God. And that's the one that we want. We want to get to, now it would be weird if we'd say get from parent-child to lovers. Of course, we don't want that in our lives. But we want to get from that top-down relationship of need and giving and receiving to a peer relationship to the extent that it's possible, where each member of the relationship is only in the relationship because they choose to be and want to be. And the relationship is only as strong as that choice is, which is why I spoke about the 22-year-old, because they still, let's make it a 30-year-old, let's just assume that by 30 they're financially independent, right? So, God willing. I hear some snickers, but God willing, right? So, whatever age, they're totally independent or could be independent, and they still choose to be in a relationship. It's a very different relationship because they don't need you anymore, they want you. Right, so but the relationship really is only as strong as the desire of, as the lowest desire of the two of you to be in that relationship. So that's the case with lovers. Lovers are only in the relationship to the extent that they both choose to be in that relationship, and only to the extent the relationship is only measured by the least amount of desire to be in it. So the one of the two lovers that has the lowest level of desire is the one that defines the level of the relationship because the other one has been met there. Right? Does that make sense? Right. So that the relationship is two-sided to the lowest level, because not two-sided to the highest level.
So, rewinding the tape a little bit, you were talking about Abraham and his 10 tests, and you know how they become full breaks from his history up until that point, and they're hard to imagine just from our perspective, although they're telling. You talked about some concept of releasing your future, and how is that related to this?
So I didn't talk about each test as being releasing the past, just as the first test being releasing the past, and the final test as releasing the future. The first test is go from your land, leave behind everything, That's the name of the first text, Lech Lecha. Right. Go to yourself, but in order to go to yourself, you have to leave behind everything.
Sure.
So, and the tests are not to test, which we might talk about in a future class. Tests aren't to see if you have an exam, to see if you could pass it, to see how much you love God. That's not what it is. It's to bring out latent potential.
Right.
So you're pushed to a place to bring out latent potential. So if you rely on your self-definition as where you came from, so that's not as complete a self-definition as God would like to see
right.
in us.
Right.
So that could be an ingredient, but he doesn't want us to rely on that. And the same thing with our future, is that we shouldn't just be about what we are going to give or where we're headed, but there's something about being where we are that's vital. So to release the past and release the future are the bookends of his 10 tests. Mm-hmm. Other ones create a different releases of potential, concretizations of his potential, latent potential. But these two are about releasing past and releasing future in terms of self-definition and trying to learn to live in the present, which we said doesn't actually exist. The only present that's really there is God. So to the extent that you can live in relationship with God constantly, that gives you a present to live in.
All right, I get that. And I guess I'm more focused on that last final test.
Of releasing the future.
Releasing the future and how it is that... You know, he's been so consistently, he's so consistently followed these tests and sort of succeeded in them and not backed down from the task. And he's about to do it for the 10th time. How is that, that is releasing a lot of future for the Jewish people. I get that, right? But is that kind of where that point is?
It's releasing the future of the Jewish people, releasing everything, but it's also releasing everything he's worked towards. You know, it's like writing your whole thesis for your PhD and then just putting it through the shredder and walking away. Like everything that you spent the last 10 years on, and you're not going to bring it to that final stage, the place where it makes the difference, where you get the degree, where you have the reputation, where your information is now out there in the world that can make a difference. That's what God was saying to do. Put it all in the shredder, everything you spent your life working on.
Mm-hmm.
Totally let go of it. Do you trust me that much?
Right.
That's what he was saying. Well, trust me enough to say that everything you've worked on until now doesn't actually matter.
Right.
It's interesting. I was just thinking about in the elections, and I won't say who I want to win, but there are definitely people who feel that it's such divergent paths in choosing either president that we're going to go in very different directions depending on who gets elected, right? So I passed a sign of the candidate I'd rather not have, and I said, please, don't make him win, please make the right. And then I said, okay, I have to let go of that. Please make the right person win for the future of the Jews in America. Not just the Jews, but America, all your children, Hashem. Whatever's supposed to be right, please help that person win. And just let go of whoever I'm attaching a name to, but just let that happen. Just release it. Hashem, you're going to run everything. So on the one hand, I want to work towards a certain candidate winning, and on the other hand, I totally trust Hashem to run our future. And he's going to make the right thing happen no matter who gets elected, right or wrong, good or bad. In the end, it's all going to be wrapped up into a picture of it's the right place eventually. So there is the living in the tension of opposites of working towards a goal and letting go with that,
sure.
releasing the results at the same time.
Or thinking about it, like we were talking with Rabbi Levin about ego. Is your ego wrapped up in the future? Is your ego wrapped up in your past?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to let go of those to some extent to be in relationship.
Right.
But if you, but it's not like you give up your future. Or you
no,
give up
you
your
don't. No, it's very tricky stuff, all this.
Realizing the importance.
But if you, if you give up what you're working for in the future, what do you have? Just
you
a promise?
You don't give it up. But you do give it up. That's the trick. It's really difficult.
Yeah.
Well, isn't it like when you go into a surgery, you don't say, make me well. You just say, give the surgeon the skills that he needs to do what he has to do.
But you still have the goal of
You still want to be well. You still want to have in mind, make me well.
That's what I'm wondering.
I want to be healthy here.
When you give up your future, you stepping
but
into
you're
a
demanding
void.
Something.
You're not giving it up.
You're allowed to demand. You're absolutely allowed to demand from God to Right, but the trick is, I mean, I have found lately that I'm often giving God advice when I actually should be letting God figure it out.
Sometimes I think of it as a human being, we're just not meant to carry the kind of burdens that we allow ourselves to carry. And sometimes
right.
we just have to let it go because we're just not designed to take it all on like that.
Not just to take it on, but you can't. I mean,
and it doesn't mean you become
complacent, apathetic,
not
just
at all.
Let it go and become a
right
couch potato, worthless. No, you're still working towards your goals and your dreams, but then you have this understanding, like, also in your head of, like, it's just not all up to me.
Correct. Right. So you have to do the best that you can with the tools that you have and then let go. Right? So you're...
You have a very, very, very stressful life.
Yes. You could have a very... So it can lighten the stress in your life. It could make your life more stressful. It depends all on your chemistry, your personality, everything. But you're pregnant, right?
You're not pregnant.
A person is pregnant. A woman is pregnant. I like it when I say pregnant people. That's like the one time you don't say people, right? A woman is pregnant, right? A couple is pregnant. And they're thinking about what they want for this child, right? Then they give birth. That person gives birth. And they see that, you could see right away, Down syndrome. Oh, completely different. Not going to be a college professor, right? Autism, can't see right. Down syndrome, not college professor. Autism, perhaps. I'm going to go hear Temple Grandin speak this week, right? Autistic college professor, possible. You don't see autism at birth, though. You only see autism a little bit later. But you don't know. You have all your hopes and dreams, and you have to keep reinventing and keep reinventing, and then do your best with the tools you have. And the moment that you have those tools, and even your tools change, right? I was just talking to a friend who's in her 70s now, and she said, you know, my tools have changed. It's so frustrating. I have similar goals to what I had before. I have some different goals too, but I have some similar, but I have a whole different toolbox, you know? Shem's taken away some old ones and given me some new ones, but they're not the same, and I have to learn how to use these. And I think about that with my son-in-law, who's a quadriplegic in a wheelchair, you know, who was very active hiking and skiing and whatever he did, and now he has a different set of tools. Very strong servant of Hashem. But he has a very different set of tools. He's no longer going to be the camp counselor who's great with adventurous Orthodox boys, taking them in the wilderness for encounters with God. That's not him anymore, right? He has to figure out how to do what he needs to do with the tools that he has, not with the tools that he had, right? So each one of us has to figure out how to be in the moment with the tools that we have, trying to achieve the goals that we have. And then our goals change and our tools change, and we have to be there too. So we don't release what we want. We'll reassess what we want, but we do have to release the results at some point. So that's why it says in Pirkei Avot, it's not upon you to finish the work, and neither are you free to desist from attempting it. Right? So world peace. I totally want world peace. I'm not like my mom, who at 6 p.m. every day has an alarm on her watch where she prays, and she does a finger mnemonic, and she prays for herself. I forgot what it is. Prays for herself, prays for family, prays for community, prays for the world, and prays for something else. And she touches each one, and then she just prays for peace. And it's a one-minute prayer that she does every day at 6 o'clock because she wants world peace, right? Okay, so whatever, I'm not doing that, but I do try to work towards world peace in whatever ways I can, whether it's giving money to something, or writing a letter to Congress, or working in my own family, or working in my own prayer, whatever it is, I want that. Is that something that I'm going to shift my entire life to go? I'm not. And sometimes I feel a little guilty. Well, shouldn't I get on a plane and fly over to Darfur and try to change things over there? I mean, it's pretty bad. You know? If I really care, why am I just writing a letter or signing a petition and thinking, should I sign? Shouldn't I sign? I'm really busy right now. I don't know how many clicks it's going to take me to get to the petition page. Like, really? I belong on a plane. Like, I should go there, right, if I really care. But I guess I don't care enough because I'm sitting here instead. Or do I say, there's only certain things I can do, and then you have to be honest with what can you do and what can't you do, and what results are in your hand and what aren't, right? So you're raising children. You have goals with them. All you can do is the best you can, and then you have to let go. Open up your hand and let them fly in their direction, not yours. It's a very frustrating thing as a parent that they all have their own desires and go where they want to go instead of where you want them to go. And you just have to let go. And instead of saying, God, please make my kid the best designer possible, right? Because that's giving God advice. It's God, please make my kid realize her potential to the best effect for her and the world as possible. And just let go of what you think it might be, right? But you want the best.
It seems like it's more acceptance than letting go. It's just accepting the moment and the tools you have, or...
Well, it's both, because you still want to work with it and work towards a goal. So you don't want it to become complacency, but you do have to let go of the ultimate result.
Can you not then pray for a specific thing?
Yes, you can.
Thing?
I need a parking space right now. Please give me one. Absolutely.
That's not
absolutely
giving God advice.
No, it's asking for what you want.
But if something you want is, your example was your child to be a whatever, or if you want something else specific, not necessarily parking space,
No, so you can ask for specific things that you want, but in the end, look, sometimes I get caught up in, let's say, I want my child to be successful. Look, let him get accepted to the PhD, MD-PhD program he's applied for. Right? So should I say that? Okay, maybe I could say that. But really what I want is for him to be able to use his intellectual and emotional abilities to the best effect for the world. So if he needs to be a physician, if he needs to be a researcher, if he needs the 2 degrees blended, I don't really know what's best for him. Why should I ask Hashem to get him into a particular school when really what I want is for him to do the best that he can in his life? So maybe I'm thwarting the right prayer. Maybe I'm thwarting the right result by that prayer. Maybe he'll get into that school because I prayed for that instead of doing what's best, which is to be rejected from that school and go through the whole year of depression that he's going to go through for being rejected, and then the whole reassessment where he's going to meet the girl he's going to marry and find the program in Bali that he's going to do research on that's going to change everything, right? Who knows, right? Yes.
So, I hear that, but in the context of this conversation we were having before about, you know, the kind of relationship you want to have with God, and, you know, is it one as a child and parent, or is it one of more of a lover relationship, sort of willfully entered as an older child mm-hmm. and parent? It seems like asking for things of God is a lot like what my kids do, you know, when in the context of the mm-hmm. supermarket, right? I mean, we had
right.
this conversation before, but that... But what's the more adult-framed...
Right, so we have to start out with the kid. That's the thing. Yeah. In order to become the lover, we do have to go through childhood, at least. You can't expect a 10-year-old to behave the same way as a 25-year-old behaves. Right, so
that's
each one of us has to move through those stages. And a 25-year-old's very different than a 45-year-old. Now, it's a very different relationship, early marriage and later marriage. After a couple of decades of marriage, the relationship's very different.
Yeah.
So you do have to move through developmental stages. So we will move into prayer that is asking for what you want, and then move into more mature stages of trust, where you know you can trust your spouse. It's very different when you're early married. You can't fully, you do pretty much trust your spouse, but it's not the same kind of trust that you have much later, right? When my husband says, can you do me a favor? I never say, what is it? I always say, sure, what is it? Right? But sure is first. Because I know for sure he's not going to ask something that I can't do or that's not going to work.
Right.
You know, I might say I can't do it today or whatever it is, but, you know, I totally trust his request.
Right, yeah, right.
So, and that's different than when you're first dating or newly married. And you're not, first it's what? Tell me what it is, then I'll tell you if I'm going to do it.
I don't know if this is on topic, but kind of like you were saying about, you know, praying for a specific program, and then if it doesn't happen, is our thought process, say it doesn't happen, to believe that everything happens for a reason, or that our job is to make the best out of any scenario given the results?
Both. Everything does happen for a reason.
But
it's our job to work to the best degree that we can with the tools and situation that we have.
Do we have to believe that everything happens for a reason? Is that a core belief?
Oh, that's a great question, and we're going to answer that hopefully the next week or the week after that, 2 more weeks. Yes, there is, and we will talk about that. But let's not talk about it now because it's a longer discussion. It's a great question, but let's go there. But let's do prayer a little bit now. So, okay, taking on our fifth principle here, and I made a whole sheet for this. So the fifth principle is, I believe with complete faith that the Creator, blessed is his name, is the only one to whom it is proper to pray, and that it is inappropriate to pray to anyone or anything else. Right? So prayer. So what is prayer? That's why I wanted this whole long introduction to be able to understand this a little bit. So when we talk about prayer, the first definition of prayer that we have is a combination of praise, request, and thanks. When we say in Judaism that we have an obligation to pray every day, which we do biblically have an obligation to pray once a day, that's the minimum daily requirement. So how does one fulfill that? With a combination of praise, request, and thanks. So that could be in a sitter. You know, you could say the Amida prayer covers that. Or the blessings on the Torah covers that, has all three. Or Birkat HaMazon, the blessing after eating a meal that includes bread, covers that. All those have praise, requests, and thanks, and will take care of your minimum daily requirement. Or you can make up your own, right? You can just say, God, the world is so beautiful. The air feels so yummy today. It's great how you made this day, right? Please help me get to the class on time. And thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to be able to teach. That's it. I did it. Praise, request, thanks. Right? It's just a combination of the three. right? For a younger mom, you know, thank you for allowing the children that you gave me are so beautiful. Please help me get them out the door this morning without forgetting anything in their backpacks. Thank you so much for getting them on the bus on time. Right? You probably drive your kids, but I had a school bus, and if I didn't get them on the bus, I did have to drive them, and it was always a big thank you once the bus came and the kids and left with the kids on it, because it didn't always happen. Okay, so praise request and thanks, that's the minimum daily requirement. So that is a basic look at prayer, and there are three different types of individual prayers too, so that's just the how you fulfill the minimum daily requirement, but there's plenty of prayers that are just that, just praise, or just request, or just thanks. That can happen too, and that's fine in our own words or in the words of the sitter. And that's just connecting to God in kind of that more childlike way, kind of more the parent-child way of please give me, or it's so nice that you, I appreciate this, or whatever it is, thank you for that. So that's more of that type of relationship. But I want to take it a little bit past that, because a lot of us have explored that type of prayer in the past, or maybe not, but given the time constraints that we have, we're not going to go further there. I want to take it a level deeper. So there's that basic level of prayer. So first, let's just say God does not need our prayers, right? God knows exactly what we need, exactly what we want, and he doesn't need to hear from us to know that. He can read our hearts, and he can read our minds. He doesn't have to say anything. So why do we say it? So we first look at... Why?
For us.
It has nothing to do with God. It has everything to do with us. It has to do with us articulating it. And our prayer in general, not always, but to fulfill the commandment of prayer every day, it has to be spoken, not just thought. So there could be some prayers that are thought. But in general, we speak prayer because it has to go from the potential into the actual. So making it into speech brings it into an actual existence. And so we do want to take the potential thought and actualize it through speech.
So if we are praying for the wrong thing, like God knows what we really need and what we really want, and but like your whole example with Bali, and if we're praying for the wrong thing, like don't worry about it too much because God knows what's really going to...
Well, so then you can really say, so you might want to say...
Like,
you might
pray for something very specific.
Pray for the specific thing and then just say, or whatever you think is best, Hashem. You know, like you ask for what you want. So sometimes what I do, as I'll say, what I'd really like is a parking space right in front of the building, right? What I'd really like is this kid to get an A on the test. But I understand that you know better, so I'm just casting my vote. Please take it into consideration. But what I really want is for this kid to do the best in life as possible, so that's what I'm asking for. You know, so you could do it like that. So just like letting, so that you're engaging in the prayer process, but also acknowledging that God knows better than you. So why should he fulfill your wish of the something lower when really what your wish is something higher? So try to get into touch with that higher wish, or just give that higher wish to Hashem. Hashem, you know what this kid needs to succeed. I'm just, as the mom, just throwing prayers out there. Please take my prayer energy and wrap it up into the right bundle for that child, because I don't even know what to do with that child right now. Right? Just like take my thoughts and hopes and dreams and give it to that kid in the way that you know is best.
This is kind of connected to your whole letting go idea.
Right.
Because it's hard to not believe that you know what's best.
Right. So, but you do, sometimes you do want to pray for the specific thing. A kid's having a real hard time in friendships. They got a kid to accept an invitation after school to come over to your house. And now you can say, please, Hashem, help their playtime go well. You know, please help her grow in this friendship. Please help there not be a meltdown. Please, like, you could ask that specifically. So that's okay, too. And at the end, you know, she's going to be who she is and whatever it is. But, yeah, you can ask for that play date to go well, especially when they're struggling with friendship or whatever it is. So you do ask for specific things. You know, please help her teacher be kinder. Please help the boss give a raise, whatever it is. We ask for specific things.
Higher knowledge that God will do with
us. Yeah, yeah. Which is why at the end of Shemona Esrei, at the end of the Amida prayer, we say, may the words of my, may the words of my lips and the meditations of my heart be accepted before you. Meaning, I didn't express everything. Please take what I expressed and reach inside and grab the rest and make that part of the prayer. Okay, so there's that aspect, which, again, God doesn't need, but we need as a self-reflecting process and also as a meditative process, which is why we want to pray in our own words for the things that we want, and sometimes we also want to use a sitter, because the sitter has arranged things that we should want. We don't even always connect to wanting. But it can help us review that these are things that should be part of our lives, and if we don't connect to it, let's learn enough to be able to connect to it somehow, because these are actually deeply rooted things which will make a difference once we understand them. So there's that. But in it, so that's the self-reflective way, and it has to do with our connection. So one example of, that I've used before that doesn't have to do with God, but it has to do with us, is just imagine the 9-year-old girl watching her older sister get ready for the prom, right? Or the 9-year-old girl down the block, right? So she tells the 18-year-old, "You're so pretty," right? As she sees her put on the gown and everything. So does the 19-year-old, 18-year-old really feel complimented? Not so much. Because the 9-year-old, what does she really know about what the 18-year-old wants to look like? So really that expression of "she's so pretty" is connecting for the 9-year-old to the 18-year-old. It allows a connection to happen, but the 18-year-old's really unaffected by the compliment because she doesn't take into account the opinion of a child that age. But the expression helps connect the 9-year-old to the 18-year-old. She gets to touch some of the glamour and bring it into herself. Like, "I want that, I desire that, I want a connection with you. Look how pretty you are." So in a way, that's what our prayers are like. It's us looking at Hashem who doesn't need what we have to say at all. Right? We're so little that it doesn't matter. When we say that, "God, you made the most gorgeous mountains," really, does your opinion matter? You know, like, who are you to say the mountains are beautiful? Except for when you say it, you connect to Hashem. So it is for us, not for God. He doesn't need our opinion on the mountains. But we connect when we see it and we say it.
But He wants us to connect.
He wants us to connect. Right, He wants us to connect. So we connect in those different ways of praising, of requesting, and of thanking. Those are all different connection pathways to us. He doesn't need our words, but He does desire us to connect. Because the more we connect, the more He can connect with us. We are the lowest common denominator in the relationship. In the lover relationship, we're the lowest one. So the more we connect, the higher we get, the closer we get to meeting God where He is in loving us. Right? So that's why He wants us to do it. Is not because He needs to hear our requests or our praise or our thanks, but because when we do it, we connect a little more and a little more and a little more, and it brings us up closer to the lover relationship from the kid relationship. So that's reason number one of prayer, is that. Reason number two is what I put here, cosmic energy. God made us in God's image. God is a creator. God created the world through speech, and so made a pathway of speech as a creative pathway, and then gifted us with speech and said, "I made you in my image. You can use speech to create things, and not just relationships, and not just jobs, and not just jokes. You can use your speech to create on the cosmic level, like I did." And so when we say, and this is where the prayers of the sitter come in, the prayers of the sitter were designed by people who understand the chemistry of language, not just what the words mean, but how you put letters and words together that create, really you're going into Kabbalah here, create a mystical influence, impact in a way that we can't understand. But we just do it, and we're playing, it's like playing the notes. I don't know how to write music, but I could play the notes. And when I play the notes, something beautiful comes out of the instrument, right? So when I play those notes, it impacts on the universe in a way that I've been gifted to be able to interact with. And so I can use my power of speech to walk on the path that God blazed to create worlds through that. So that's why it pays occasionally to actually say a prayer from the sitter, because it has both those abilities, both the first ability to connect and the second ability to cosmically impact the universe, which we don't have with just our own words. We do have the ability to connect with just our own words, but unless we understand how to use words and letters in combination, we can't do the second part, the cosmic impact, on our own. For that, we need more wisdom and knowledge of how to make the letters work. That being said, though, what I really want to move to...
Can I ask you a question about
yes.
the relationship?
Yes.
When you describe the relationship that we have with God, and it starts like a parent-child, and then it moves to like a lover relationship, in a lover relationship, it's a two-way relationship. How do we get that relationship back from God if... that is the concept that is hard for me to grasp.
Right. It is a difficult concept, and it's a concept that, you know, it's very distracting, right? It's a concept that you can only get as you enter it. Just like you can't explain parenthood to an 18-year-old who's babysat a lot, right? But they can't understand the love of a parent, cannot, even though they love the kids they babysit for, or they love their younger siblings. They cannot understand what a parent feels for a child. And neither can somebody who's been dating, somebody in college they've been dating for three, since high school. They have the same date, the same girlfriend or boyfriend, right? And now they're 22. They don't know what marriage feels like, right? They can't know what it feels like until they're in it. So the same thing with that lover relationship with God. You can't explain it. You can only feel it as it develops in you. How does that develop? So that's what I want to get here with the meditation, right? So God created us in God's image and then directed us to behave like God. So there's many different God-like ways that we behave in, but let's talk about a specific one here. So we talked about how God moved God's self aside, created a tzimtzum, a contraction, in order to create space for us to live inside God, right? In order for us to be like God, we have to contract ourselves and move part of ourselves aside to create space in us for God to live in us. That's where meditation and prayer, meditation being a subset of prayer, comes in. Because one aspect of prayer is that opening up of self and moving ego out of the way, moving the definition of past and future out, connecting totally to the present, but being in the relationship where you start to feel, just like in a marriage, you have to move part of yourself out of the way to be in relationship with that person. It can't be all about you. If it's all about you, it's not a marriage. It's two people living in parallel with a legal contract, right? But hopefully over the years, it becomes something where you're enmeshed in each other because you've created space for each other. Sometimes violently and sometimes pleasantly and sometimes through trust and sometimes through tears. But you create a space inside you for the other to live there. So it starts off in physical, right? That a man lives inside his wife physically, and then it becomes a spiritual metaphor for living enmeshed in each other, creating oneness out of the separateness of you. Yes.
Tell me if it goes both ways. If you could say God is part of me, but also the other way, it says I am part of God.
Absolutely. So I want to tell you the most beautiful story I heard while I was at a conference. I was very privileged to be invited to the Jewish Week's The Conversation this year. So the Jewish Week, the Federation / New York secular Jewish newspaper of record in the New York area, probably at the national secular newspaper, Jewish newspaper of record. Every year they convene a conversation of 50 Jews from across the country in different fields to just talk about being Jewish in America for 2 days. So I got to go to that this year. A Reform rabbi told a story that I loved there, a story that he gave a family service, which means he gave a sermon that he was hoping that by talking to the kids, the parents would get something out of, right? As he's following a mother and a four-year-old child out of the service, he hears the conversation between mother and child. So daughter, four-year-old, says, "Mommy, I didn't understand what the rabbi said." I said, "Okay, what's your question?" I said, "Well, didn't the rabbi say that God is bigger than us?" "Yes, did say that." "And didn't the rabbi say that God lives in each of us?" "Yes, the rabbi did say that." "Well, if God is bigger than us, but he lives inside of us, wouldn't he show through?" "Yes, that's the whole point, is we're supposed to live in a way in which God shows through, that he lives in us and we live in him, and that it is a mixture, but that we live in such a way that we've gotten enough of ourselves out of the way that we become transparent vessels of God's light in the world and God shows through. That really is the point of it all. And that's what can be accomplished through prayer and meditation, is such a deep connection to the straight up that when you're living linearly, you're living totally connected and God is showing through. That's really what's supposed to happen. So it is a constant life's work to clear out a little bit more and clear out a little bit more and let go a little bit more and take hold a little bit more. Because it's not just about letting go, it's about what can you take hold of? How can you integrate that connection into your life so that you feel it? So that it is a relationship that goes both ways. So that you feel lived in and comforted by that presence, surrounded by the presence and filled with the presence, that it is a relationship that goes both ways. It's only something you could understand when you start to feel it, and you can only feel it when you start to let it happen. So it's only living into it that allows one to experience what I'm trying to talk around, because there are no words for that relationship. But it is supposed to be. That's why we have parables in this world, and marriage, being lovers, is a parable for the deepest relationship with God. That relationship of living in and through and with and around and totally enmeshed in, going from both directions. That's what we're aiming towards. And that's what could be created. Prayer and meditation is a tool that helps create that.
And then God saw that living within you, you just wouldn't be able to access it until you put yourself in that ability to receive.
Right, in a way it's like tuning a radio. But it's not just tuning. It's also developing. So the first level is tuning into the broadcast frequency to feel the broadcast, to hear the broadcast that's always there, right? But the second is really developing yourself in relationship. You know, just like your parents broadcast to you, I love you, you hear it in different ways depending on how developed you are, right? Now that you're a parent, you hear it totally differently than you did at 18, totally differently than you did at 10, even though you could hear it then, and you couldn't hear it at 1 because you didn't know what those words meant, right? But you develop first the capability to tune into it, and then you have to develop into the receiver that can actually hear it and understand it depending on your level of achievement. So it's both how that works. Okay, I guess we'll end there and hopefully pick up next week.